Okay, so I'm just coming back home from a little trip to Scotland, where I went with my family to the Scottish Wild Food Festival, and I met other herbalists, and it was a really great, fun, amazing event with lots of learning opportunities and herb walks and activities. It was really, really fantastic for the whole family. And one of the organizers is a woman called Rox Madeira, and she has her own herbal podcast. It's called The Sage's Cabin, and I was listening to a few episodes and heard her talking about this Scottish Wild Food Festival. I immediately, after hearing this episode while I fell asleep in bed the night before, I woke up and researched about this festival, and I booked the flight tickets the same day, pretty much. It was a very spontaneous decision 2 weeks before the festival started. I planned the little trip and we went there, and it was really fantastic. I met Rox, so hey, if you're listening, lots of greetings to you. It was really fantastic, the festival they organized there. So many activities, and of course it was a whole experience to travel to Scotland and see nature and the herbs that grow there and the different climate and how green it is here compared to Portugal. I live in Portugal, here in the south of Europe, where it's very dry. So it was amazing, and it triggered a lot of, you know, just ponderings and reflections in myself about, you know, the way we use herbs, the way, you know, which herbs we use, what grows outside, and the whole history of herbalism, actually, because it has a lot to do, of course, you know, with British settlers in the US learning, or in America, in North America, I should say, learning from Native American herbalism, and how, you know, this Western herbalism coming mixed with the Native herbalism there, and what we use today and have today, and all the plants and books and everything that make up what we call Western herbalism. Of course, there are so many healing systems in the world and other really important big systems that have survived and have also a very rich own history, like Ayurveda, for example, or other traditions, of course. But yeah, so I got some insights thinking about the history of Western herbalism that I would like to share with you. So let's dig into the weeds. Okay, first let me just mention, I have herbal classes coming up. So at the moment I'm doing one herbal class a month live. You can ask your questions in the end. It was really, really nice so far. With many people participating and sharing, and we had a nice discussion in the end together. So this week, so now it's September, so this would be on Thursday, 29 of September, but you know, any day in the future you are listening to this episode, they might be classes coming up. So at the moment I'm doing them once a month, maybe in the future more often. So just check the link in the description, the Ko-fi link, and you can sign up for these classes and come, which I would be really happy about if you join. So this week we talk about brain health, everything from ADHD to memory and focus and brain function, anxiety, anything that has somehow to do with the brain. And we talk about some brain herbs, for example, gotu kola and other herbs and supplements that are helpful in these situations. And so join my class. You can sign up through the link in the description. And if the time has already passed, there will be classes. I'm going to do one class a month at the moment, so you can sign up anytime and join the classes. And also you will see these different membership tiers that I have on my Ko-fi site. So this is just to organize these signups for you, for the herb students. So the herb student tier or the case study tier get access to the live classes. And then I have the herbal inspiration tier, which is the lowest priced tier, where you can sign up for my herbal videos. For example, this week I have coming up a video about the herbs I took on my trip and how I organized my herbs and supplements during the trip, and which herbs I took, also for the family, for situations that could come up while you're traveling. So most of it is, of course, really specific also to my health situation, but it can help you, you know, to think about, okay, how can you adapt your herbs during travels. Yeah, for example, maybe you do not want to do your 30-minute decoction of whatever route you are taking. You know, maybe you take capsules instead. Maybe you can pause certain herbs and supplements for a week because it really doesn't make a big difference. Yeah, so some herbs and supplements, it would make a big difference and it would not be wise to pause them while you're traveling. Maybe you need them especially when you're traveling to keep your energy up and your immune system strong. But other herbs, you know, or other supplements, you know, maybe you don't really have to take your omega-3 fish oil or whatever, which could spill in the luggage and, you know, could make a big mess. So definitely, you know, don't take any oily substances and instead capsules or powders or other more easily transportable forms of herbs. So I show you what I took in a little video that I will publish on for all members, no matter what tier you sign up on the Ko-fi membership. You get access to this video this week and also, of course, to all the other, I think, like 20-25 videos that I have already posted there that you can enjoy and watch. All are like little mini classes about an herb or health condition or any other natural health related topic. Okay, so let's talk a bit about Scotland. It was really, really amazing. I was really impressed, and the whole family, also the kids, were amazed by, you know, you get out of the plane and it's just this different air, different things you see and smell, and, you know, the temperature is different. And I mean, we had really good weather. I mean, I think September is probably the best time, or spring or early autumn is the best time to go to Britain. And we almost didn't have any rain, like really like short, yeah, 2 times 10 minutes, a little bit of rain, and the rest was sunny and cloudy and nice, and, you know, this fresh air of autumn. So it was not hot or anything, but it was also not very cold, and we were, of course, prepared with our rain boots and rain jackets and everything. But yeah, it was really nice. We were really lucky, and I mean, this wonderful event organized by Rox Madeira and other herbalists of Scotland. I mean, they put together a really nice little festival and event with lots of talks and herb walks and, of course, wild foraged foods, and actually a big banquet of amazing wild foods with top chefs that cooked all this up. And I mean, it was really a lot of fun for the whole family. And yeah, just wandering around, you know, looking at all these castles that pop up everywhere. You know, you can visit, you know, all kinds of different castles. And I mean, it just oozes history, this whole place. So yeah, that's maybe what kind of brought me to this idea, to talk about the history of herbalism. And I'm not an expert at all. Actually, I'm just going through here some materials from my herbal course that I did with my dear teacher, KP Kalsa. He gave us a wonderful introduction. It was part of our studies of the several years of studying professional herbalism with him. And I was just looking up my materials. I mean, he knows all this stuff and he tells it in such an interesting, engaging way. And for me, it's all like, oh my gosh, you know, the Greeks, the Romans, and I can't really remember the dates and all the order of all these things that happened. But, you know, I have a general sense, or yeah, I got a general sense of, I mean, I'm still developing, no, my whole idea about this history of herbalism. And, you know, how, of course, we as humans, I mean, it starts with the monkey in the tree, you know, it starts even before we were even called humans, I guess, you know, that we were eating plants and eating roots. We know that even animals choose certain foods to heal themselves from their stomach cramps, or, you know, they know which grass to eat to vomit out a food that is not sitting well in the stomach or whatever. They eat, foods to treat certain health problems that they have, and they know really well which herbs and foods to eat. So, of course, for us humans, it's also this really evolution-long process, yeah, of living and of this co-evolution with plants that we have, yeah, that we really have co-evolved with. And our whole being and how we are, our health, how we look, of course, has to do with the plants and our environment around us, yeah. And often, okay, of course, the line between food and medicine is a thin line. You know, some foods have and were always super foods that we took to strengthen and prevent illness and strengthen the body, and then also the really serious medicines that you would really just take when you need them for specific situations. So this knowledge has been with us forever. That's why, you know, there is, yeah, probably, hopefully, no end to this. And I mean, we went through a lot of crises and changes in this whole history of herbalism. So, you know, like in more recent history, let's say, I mean, this was probably 1600 something, I don't know, Paracelsus. He was the guy, you know, who brought it all down to this scientific approach of using basically chemicals. I mean, he first experimented like with minerals, and these turned later into the chemicals that we know today that we call pharmaceuticals, that are to treat a specific disease and condition. So there was this thought, you know, that, yeah, for any disease and condition, you can find this one chemical slash pharmaceutical that would treat the disease. And we threw out, or no, Paracelsus in that moment with him, it kind of started that, you know, it was thrown out the knowledge about, you know, energetics, and, you know, the Greek knew about the humors. Yeah, this is very similar to how Ayurveda sees illness in the body in terms of energetics. Yeah, somebody being too hot or too wet or too cold or too dry. Yeah, to match a remedy to these more physical characteristics and this holistic view of a person. Yeah, it switched at that point to just treating the disease. Yeah, it doesn't matter, you know, who has the diarrhea or the fever or whatever. It's like this remedy for that. There's a remedy to treat with the fever. There's a remedy to treat the diarrhea or whatever. And it's not like, oh, this person, you know, has a pitta excess or whatever, or is too phlegmatic or sanguinic, or, you know, this would be in terms of speaking of the Greek humors. But it's basically the same, you know, it's energetics, yeah. It was a factor, you know, taken into account if this person has more like a heated up metabolism and tends maybe to anger, and we have to cool and soothe them and create more balance in the body. And that's how we choose the herbs, and that's how we give these herbs, as opposed to, okay, in this person, we are just treating the stomach ulcer, you know, and there's this one pharmaceutical that helps with stomach ulcer, no matter who has the stomach ulcer and what other symptoms in the body are present. And this is the model we have today. Yeah, this is basically what modern medicine has reduced itself to, because, you know, before and also in other cultures, in China, for example, herbs still are part of medicine, yeah, of the medicine that is practiced in that country. Yeah, they don't even differentiate between herbs and pharmaceuticals. They use both, and herbs fall under the same strict regulations as pharmaceuticals. Yeah, they have to be tested, and they have to be, you know, grown in a certain way that they have their properties that they should have. And so, of course, yeah, I'm speaking here more about this Western context that I know about. Yeah, I'm born and raised in Germany, and I have lived a long time in South America, in Brazil, and now I'm living since 6-7 years here in Portugal, in the south of Europe. So, yeah, it was just also, you know, striking me hard, like, seeing the hawthorn berries in Scotland. Yeah, I mean, I think whole Britain is covered in these, and also in Germany, also in the more northern European countries. Even here, I mean, we have hawthorn berries and hawthorn hedges or trees here in Portugal. So in Britain, in Scotland, they were actually hedges. Yeah. So this is the main herbs. I mean, you can see all these hedges that kind of separate the fields from the cows and all this. You know, they have a function. They have always, yeah, have been there since a long time. So this is mainly, you know, hawthorn, elderberry, rose hips. I mean, amazing, you know, and all these berries and the brambles, yeah, the wild blackberries that we also have here, yeah, but in Scotland they are so big and juicy and sweet because, of course, they have more rain, they have more water, yeah, so everything in this dry climate, we have basically a summer without a drop of rain, yeah, we have literally, yeah, between May and October, it doesn't rain, I mean, yeah, in September now we had a bit of rain already, but let's say at least between May and September, it's completely dry here. And still, you know, at the end of these dry months, we do have the wild blackberries and the fennel seeds and the hawthorn berries and maybe some elderberries a bit more north from here. So where I live, we don't have that many. but a bit more north. In Portugal, there are also elderberries. Of course, we have lots of rose hips, but they are all so small and concentrated. You know, if I imagine like peeling the rose hips and, you know, because you have to take out the seeds and this itchy powder that is those little hairs that are, yeah, they are like itching powder, actually. These little hairs that are around the seeds inside of the rose hip, you have to peel every rose hip and take out the seeds and then process the thin layer of flesh, the red flesh that it has around the seed under the skin. So it's crazy work, you know. I mean, at least, you know, in Scotland, the rose hips are almost double the size or three times as big. So it's a bit more, you know, it's a bit easier to peel them and process them. And also the hawthorn berries. I mean, you can make really a hawthorn berry puree and preparations. You could make a jam out of them or a kind of a replacement for a tomato sauce. So you can use them in culinary ways, and this is how people use these herbs, of course, traditionally. Yeah, the rose hips, you can make a tea, you can make a jam out of the elderberries, of course, syrups and drinks, and these herbs are used because they are so plentiful everywhere. Yeah, it is no problem at all to wild harvest these herbs that grow really in, yeah, everywhere in such big amounts when it's harvest season. So it's pretty easy to forage these herbs there and have plenty of them. And of course, you know, maybe where you live, you don't have access to all these hawthorn hedges and rosehip hedges and elderberries, you know. And, you know, it made me think about, you know, of course, these are very classic herbs, or some would even say, oh, they are good beginner herbs and starting herbs. You know, if you start to learn herbalism, of course, you know, you use the calendula and the plantain and the elderberry and the elderflower and the hawthorn and the rosehips and all these herbs. But, you know, it always depends where you live. Yeah, if you have this easy access to them and they grow everywhere around you, which in much of northern climates, you know, of kind of temperate climates, I would say, North European or European in general, no? And kind of temperate climates in the US, you will find these herbs around the world, actually. Some of them have been brought by the European settlers. So imagine the British setting foot in North America. And, you know, the natives, they actually called the plant plantain, you know, plantain. They called it the white man's footstep because it started springing up where the settlers set foot, basically. Yeah, so, it was also plants being carried there by the dirt in the cracks of the shoes, basically. You know, I mean, some plants were consciously brought there, of course. The settlers took some of their important medicinal plants with them and took them to America. But the plantain, you know, was probably just a few seeds here and there in the cracks of their shoes or whatever that were more kind of accidentally brought to the New World or to America. And this is how plantain came there and why it's all over America now and other countries. Yeah, so... yeah, and of course, other medicinal plants the settlers brought with them and planted them consciously. And then they learned about plants, the plants of Native Americans. Of course, there also was already a lot of wisdom and use, you know, plants like boneset, echinacea, pleurisy root. These were unknown to the British settlers. And but they started writing about it, you know, they started writing and publishing about it, you know, today. That's why we have a lot of echinacea products, actually. And the Germans did a lot of research with this plant and studied it a lot. And there's a lot of preparations and research and, you know, different forms. You can go to pharmacy in Germany and buy echinacea in all forms as a tincture and as tablets and powder and extracts and everything. So yeah, some of these plants had a huge success then also later in Europe, of course. And yeah, so it's just this ongoing story of, you know, how we, you know, ever changing, ever evolving with us, of how we use plants and which plants we use, you know. And yeah, just to say, you are part of writing this history. Yeah, we are part of writing this history now. Yeah, I really want to, yeah, that you know of this importance. You know, I mean, you are writing right now your own materia medica, or you should, you know, really the herbs we use, the herbs that you use for yourself, for your family, that you teach your children how to use, or people around you, friends and family, based on what you know about them, based on if they grow around you or if they don't grow anymore around you. You know, for example, echinacea has been completely extinct from the wild, so we have all now only cultivated echinacea. So some plants are under threat, and we have to, you know, rethink if we can use them, how we can use them. We have to learn how to cultivate plants that are right now wildcrafted, for example, rhodiola from Iceland and the Arctic is under threat of being extinct, and we haven't found a way yet to cultivate it. But there are some projects. I know there is some cultivated rhodiola already available. And some put a lot of research into that, because, of course, we don't want to lose more plants in the wild. And it's our, we should protect them, of course, and be mindful while harvesting these plants for sale. And it's an ongoing history, you know. Or here, you know, I'm thinking about Portugal facing the droughts that get worse and worse. And our hawthorn berries are really small and concentrated. And, you know, our blackberries are, they're not as juicy and sweet as the ones I tasted in Scotland, for example. So, of course, the drought has an effect on the plants. Some plants are really right now in front of me disappearing from this region where I am right now. So not from Portugal, because, you know, I live in the very, very south, and more north, it's, maybe they get a bit more rain, or temperatures are different, the climate is different. So some plants, like even those big cork oaks that we have, they disappear from the very south. I mean, there's still plenty more north, but it's just the fact that for them it's too dry and too hot here, especially dry, actually, because they can cope quite well with the heat. But I mean, they need a little water, of course. And so many plants, you know, adapt to climate changes. That in different parts of the world, you know, here it's the drought increasing and everything. So, I don't have these amazing, juicy hawthorn berries to process in my kitchen. I mean, I can still process them. They are okay. They are smaller. They're not as juicy. But of course, now I'm jealous that they were so nice and big and juicy in Britain. But we have other things, you know. I mean, it's really, if I... Just from the top of my head, what are the plants that I can most kind of wildcraft and harvest from around me that are abundantly available in nature? You know, it's in early spring. And I mean, spring basically here starts as soon as November or December, because then the rain comes back and it doesn't get super cold. So it's basically a kind of spring already in the months when the rain starts. And definitely in January, February, it's in full swing. And it's all full of flowers here. And so we have kind of an early spring, and then we have this dry period, which is the summer, where everything is super dry. And still, you know, some plants give us their fruits and seeds, like the fennel plant with the fennel seeds, after this long and dry summer. So cycles might be, you know, a bit different for each plant. If I think of the top of my head, you know, there is plenty of nettle in spring. So this means, in December, January, February, plenty of nettle. There is calendula. In some years, we have a lot of wild calendula, the Calendula arvensis. So not the normal officinalis that you would plant, but a wilder, smaller one. We have cistus. I made a video about that also in my Ko-fi membership, about the cistus flowers that we have, or bushes. I mean, you can use the flowers, the leaves. There is at least 5 different types, or 6 that I remember, and they have different medicinal uses, and they are also very adapted to this dry climate. It's really amazing. And we have rose hips, we have hawthorn berries, we have elderberry a bit more north, not exactly where I am, but still in the same country. It just varies. So maybe you have completely different plants around you, and And of course, you know, we learn herbalism partly from books and partly from courses and from other people. So of course, we have our own personal materia medica is not limited to what grows around us. You know that I also work with, you know, a pretty, in part, pretty scientific idea of, you know, phytotherapy and all the studies we have and all the herbs we can get from Ayurveda and from Chinese medicine and supplements and everything. So it is a mix, of course, not between this traditional local herbalism that is at the very root of our history with plants and the modern advances in science. I mean, now science goes full circle, you know. I mean, even science, let's say, you know, they find out that, oops, maybe it's not so easy to just invent a chemical, a pharmaceutical for each disease and give it and that's it. You know, that's how we treat. Yeah, that's still how we can treat very serious disease where we're past the point almost of being able to do a lot with natural remedies. Of course, this is, yeah, in some situations, you know, absolutely justified to take pharmaceuticals. Yeah, that's just what I want to say. I'm not opposed, but I think they can't be our only pillar of healthcare. You know, they just can't, you know. I mean, there is no way you get somebody better and well if, you know, you disregard all kind of more natural minerals and supplements and herbs and plants, you know. So, sure, we could go back to our integrated health system, our holistic way of seeing things that would be way more effective for our health. Okay, so I'm just trying to get a few more facts about the history of Western herbalism here together for you, but it's really, yeah, it's a lot of data, and I know I haven't been here very thorough. It's more like, yeah, my thoughts around this topic. But so in Europe at some point, you know, we had the bubonic plague, which killed like 30 to 60% of the population. And after that, Europe went into a decline for 1,000 years and was in the Middle Ages. And, you know, it was more the Arabic world that was at the height of, you know, cultural and scientific development. So many of the things happened there. And it was actually that in the Middle Ages, the monasteries kind of preserved and handwritten copies of these old herbal texts from before, yeah, from what we already had from the Greek and Romans. And so it was the monasteries who these were the only people, you know, who could read and write in the Middle Ages. So it was on them to copy the old texts and preserve this knowledge. And up to today, you know, I mean, we actually visited an old cemetery next to a church in Edinburgh, and it had this little tiny herbal garden there with, you know, thyme and, you know, all these herbs and kitchen herbs, kitchen spices and everything. So this was normal, yeah, that, and still today, I mean, you can see that if you visit a European monastery or cloister, you can see and visit these herbal gardens. People still maintain them in many areas. It was always part of a monastery, and they preserved the knowledge, yeah. And there was this important figure, and yeah, she's a woman, she's from Germany, Hildegard von Bingen. So Saint Hildegard, she was she lived in a monastery, and she was a very kind of, yeah, I don't know how to say it, forward-thinking woman. She was not shy to even confront the Pope and other authorities in the very hierarchically structured, religious orders that were in place at that time. So she had her own opinions. Yeah, she was a mystic. She was an herbalist. She was writing many texts, philosophic texts and everything. So shows she was an intellectual of that times, actually. And yeah, she treated other people and with herbs. And she had her favorite herbs, you know, like thyme and galangal root and other remedies. Of course, we have lots of records of her healing system, and it's very popular in Germany. I mean, you can really go to the pharmacy and find her formulations and recipes and tinctures and herbs she used. They are for sale in the pharmacies, and sometimes they are still produced in cloisters or like in these monastery gardens. So yeah, you find these recipes and herbs, you find a lots of books about them and literature. So yeah, it was the monasteries who saved this knowledge. Like, I think there was, especially from Ireland, there was herbal and medicinal literature that was kind of saved and copied to save this part of culture and history in this decline of Europe. And yeah, so it's a story full of, you know, you can dive deeper in so many of these moments in time and understand more deeply what happened and how it happened. I mean, for me, it's just, you know, there were many ups and downs. There were many changes of, you know, our general idea, how we think about health. You know, it was then actually the Christian religions who at some point in the Middle Ages said, you know, now stop it with all this nonsense. You know, anything, you know, medicine in general, herbs or whatever, stop it, because, you know, illness is always provoked by, you know, kind of an illness of the spirit or of the life decisions and choices of the person. So they discarded completely with anything related to medicine. And of course, and at the same time, you also know that in the Middle Ages we had parallel people still practicing their home herbalism and their home remedies. I mean, there were many wise women, and, you know, mixed with these pagan traditions of spells and things like that. So this is, of course, also the time when the whole hysteria about witches happened. And yeah, so we went through lots of ups and downs in this whole history. And yeah, but it's still there, you know. It's, and I always hear also the story of especially kind of North American herbalism that was basically practically extinct at a certain time, and had this big revival with like Rosemary Gladstar and many others of her generation that kind of saved this knowledge and brought it back to life, including my teacher KP Kalsa. I mean, when he started practicing, he is now 67, and he says he has over 50 years of experience. I mean, he was basically 15, 16 when he started studying about herbal medicine. At that time in North America, there was very little information. There were like a few of this old kind of doctors, naturopaths that were still practicing, and he learned directly from them, and he kind of really had to scratch together pieces of this knowledge and try it out himself, and of course with people he gave herbs to. And he was also under the training of Yogi Bhajan, who was at that time in North America, so he learned from him for several decades. So I mean, yeah, this was, of course, you know, piecing together this knowledge and kind of rescuing it and applying it and seeing which herbs really work and in what dose, and, you know, how to use them in a modern way, also considering the science that was, you know, slowly happening and coming up first, like from Germany, from other countries. So yeah, this is where we are right now. Yeah, so we have it that much easier today to get herbal knowledge, to get access to it. I mean, there's a lot of free material out there, like this podcast, yay. There's, you know, classes and courses and books and everything, workshops. So yeah, it's now, it's happening, no? And, you know, I mean, I remember, you know, Rosemary Gladstar saying, when she said she's an herbalist, like, you know, when was this, like 40 years ago, people were like, what, you know, and not even aware that this exists as a thing. And today, you know, you say you're an herbalist and everybody is super positive about it. You know, I basically get only positive comments, and everybody's interested in herbal medicine, it seems, many people. So we are in a renaissance of herbalism. Yeah, and me and you, we are part of it. And, you know, it really depends on us. Yeah, don't underestimate that you play a part in, you know, keeping this knowledge alive by using it, by actually taking your herbs, finding out about them, by looking outside what grows near you, what grows in abundance that you can safely harvest, you know, without bringing any plant to extinction. So it's always good to know which plants are, of course, very abundant and grow like weed. And yeah, often they are called weeds, and yeah, we call them they are just the wild plants that are there, that are around us in the environment where you are, including all our scientific knowledge and knowledge from other systems like Chinese medicine, Ayurveda. There are so many other, of course, I mentioned these big systems, but you know, there is traditional herbalism in every country, in Latin America, in the East, in everywhere. You have those kind of smaller systems that maybe don't have all these books and written records, but people practice it. People have their, you know, people who carry the wisdom and who know how to use these herbs, how to identify them, and much of this knowledge is still not written down in many cultures, and sometimes it is kept for the native and local people, which is also totally correct, and prevents the exploitation of these local native plants. Because in the end, sure, the best is if we look outside and we have our herbs available very close to us. But yeah, not discarding, of course, that you can order herbs online. This is just also part of our reality and of the structures we created as humans and of the possibilities. You know, I couldn't work with clients online if I couldn't send them a link where to order the herbs. You know, it's difficult to tell them to go outside and look for this or that herb that might or might not grow near them. So, of course, you know, it's this mixture of ways to engage with herbalism. And I'm very thankful we have all these options and we have all this richness and aliveness of herbalism. And yeah, thanks for listening. And yeah, let me know if you have any questions. You can leave me a voice recording. Actually, here's also a link under each episode where you can send a question or just a comment via voice message. Or if not, of course, you can just write me to my email address. It's tamara@herbalhelp.net. Yeah, so there's also this website, of course, herbalhelp.net, where you can find out about health consultations if you want to get my advice for your specific personal health situation. And you can send me an email through that into that a contact form on my website. So you can go to herbalhelp.net and write me a message, write me an email, get in touch, or book a health consultation. You can also book a free call if you want to chat before, if you're not sure, where to start, how to start. You can book a free call. I post the link here directly in the description. It's directly a link to my calendar, and you can book a slot and we talk over Zoom. We can have a short little free chat to see if you would like to work with me. Yeah, and also have a look at the classes and the Ko-fi link here in the description. Maybe, hopefully, I see you in one of the next classes. Until then, have a good time and talk to you soon. Ciao, ciao.